But generally speaking, the less room Protestants, such as the Dutch, were much more much more easygoing on their Jewish population. Until the point was reached in the 1700s in France, at the time of the French Revolution, of complete emancipation. Emancipation means that the Jews regard as full co-equals and citizens of the country in which they resided.
Napoleon.
I'm sorry?
That was only in Napoleon time.
Right.
Not anymore before.
No, it remained after Napoleon in France. It remained in countries which were conquered by Napoleon, with the exception of Russia. And the emancipation became...
Russia now was conquered by Napoleon.
What?
Russia was never conquered?
Parts of it were. You know, when Napoleon got to Moscow.
A couple days.
Somebody got to Moscow.
A couple years.
What about Leningrad?
No, he never got to
Leningrad.
What Moscow he got in the...
He was in Moscow for several months.
Okay, fine, but what was the point? He left himself, Moscow. Moscow wasn't fine.
I understand, but Germany, for example, where Napoleon was for a while, the emancipation, we made a very powerful force there, even after Napoleon was defeated. And the emancipation itself originated in the French Revolution. The French Revolution was the overthrow of the monarchy and the old order, which was based on a hierarchy within society, which the Jews were usually the lowest in the hierarchy, and was based on liberty, equality, and fraternity, which means everybody was free, everyone was equal, and everybody should get along with each other. Okay? Again,
after the monarchy was restored in Europe, what happened to
the Jews? The Jews did not go back in the ghettos for the most part.
Before Jews was in the ghetto?
Yeah. You know also what was important, of course? Why Jews remained emancipated?
They were able to assimilate.
No, much more cynical than that.
Financial
institutions. Exactly. What? Money. The Rothschilds were funding all these governments, right?
The Rothschilds were the monkey.
What?
The Rothschilds.
Yeah, but it's not as the same Rothschild. Not all branches of the family became and remained rich. So, generally speaking, the Rothschilds were rich when they became not true over time. So in any event, so there was a lot of money involved, not just Rothschilds, other prominent families. And they were, so therefore, their prominence and their money was essential, so the Jews, even after Napoleon fades from the scene, remained free. Now, this freedom was already, fancy English word for this is presaged, but anticipated might be an easier word to use, by a very famous figure who rose in Germany in the mid to late 1700s, whose name was Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn was a Talmid Chacham, a great scholar, and he was quite frugal. But he was very much immersed in the general German academic and philosophical circle of the time. He was very much friendly with non-Jewish thinkers. And he also was interested in bringing the Jews to a higher level of general knowledge, as one possible the Enlightenment.
Secular knowledge,
yes. One of the things that Moses Mendelssohn is most famous for is his hashkafa. Moses Mendelssohn's hashkafa, his system of belief, was that Jews received the Torah at Mount Sinai, and they were stuck with it, and tough on them. In other words, yes, there was a revelation at Mount Sinai. Yes, the Torah was given to the Jewish people. Yes, we have to keep the Torah, but that doesn't make us better. If anything, we're worse off, right? Because the non-Jews, they can get to perfection much better than we can. Easier, I should say. Easier than we can, because they only have these 7 commandments. And we're stuck with 613. We have to keep them, because God makes us do them. It's not great. It's a big bummer, but what can you do? And Moses Mendelssohn was very meticulous in keeping mitzvahs. But the idea of mitzvahs being something which makes a person holier or better, because the person a more greater closeness to Hashem was absolutely foreign to him. In this sense, Moses Mendelssohn is called, although it's not fair to him, the father of Reform Judaism. Because since he, if you don't believe in the specialness of Orthodox Judaism, of, in other words, the mitzvot, and Torah, which gives us the mitzvot, then why keep all these laws? So Mendelssohn himself did keep them. And that's why the Reform Jews are not so happy having Mendelssohn as their father, as their Rebbe. Because he did keep the mitzvot, but the idea, the philosophy which he had, was a philosophy which paved the way for Reform Judaism to renounce not just the special quality of the Jewish nation, but also the mitzvot themselves. Right? Also, in fact, Moses Mendelssohn's progeny, his kids, almost all, if not all, I remember the exact statistics, but I believe all of them converted to Christianity,
yeah.
or at very least married non-Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was his opinion?
How did he feel about Mendelssohn? I don't know if it's recorded. The Chaim Spicer had ambivalent relationship with Mendelssohn. I think Afloah was a bit earlier.
Yes, so what did he say?
Well, on the one hand, it seems like early on he liked Mendelssohn, and later on he became less happy with him. What Mendelssohn did, one of his more controversial things, was he published a German translation of the Chumash called the Biur. Now, it's still possible to find copies nowadays. It's not published in German. It's published in Hebrew letters. But the Hebrew letters are not Hebrew, but they are German. Okay? What? It's like Yiddish, but it wasn't Yiddish. Yiddish existed at the time.
It was like writing in Hebrew?
Yeah.
Did you read the Hebrew the meaning of German?
It's not the meaning. It, the words would read as German. Yeah, like if you wrote, your t-shirt says smack, right? So if I wrote Samech Mem Kuf, right, that's what it would say, right? That was written.
Why was the Gedolim so upset at that?
Because they understood that Mendelssohn's intent was not to teach Tanakh, in which case he would have translated into Yiddish, but rather to make German a primary language of the Jews of the time. So they saw it as a move towards, I don't know if assimilation is the right term, because Mendelssohn himself is not assimilated, but a move towards greater contact and interaction between the Jewish and non-Jewish communities.
Secularization.
If you want to call it secularization, call it secularization. But not, I just don't want to call it assimilation. But there was a point. So this Biur was a very, very controversial thing. And some people used it, some people didn't use it. And the Chasam Sofer, if I recall correctly, was the one who said it was forbidden to read the Biur. Nowadays, we regard this as relatively harmless because we're used to translations, we're used to reading English translations, but for that, it was a revolutionary thing at the time. It's because we're morons and because we're all, you know, we were at that breakthrough work. So, Rishon Zofar Hirsch did the same thing, right? It's answered towards the German. By that time, 50 years later, when Rishon Zofar Hirsch translated terms into German, so he could already put it out not just in Hebrew characters, but his Chumash was put out in German, right? Why? Because by that it was such a great change, a shift from the mid 1700s to mid 1800s that what was mid 1700s Jews were speaking Yiddish and German was a novelty. In the mid 1800s, the Jews of Germany spoke German. And they looked down on Yiddish as this Polish language. Okay, so things changed very fast, relatively speaking, not just in the, so to speak, non-Orthodox camp, but even the Orthodox camp. Many years ago, I'm answering a question with a story, okay? Many years ago, when I was in Kolon Farakhoi, but this goes back to the late 1980s, I think about 1987 or so, 20 years ago. So at the Kolon which I was learning, put out a kind of newsletter, magazine newsletter, Tiferet Torah newsletter in English. So it was. So he brought one of the copies to the local Hasidic Rebbe, the Pulitzer. And I know how he's still alive, he's a very old man. So the Pulitzer took a look at that, and we thought he'd be very happy. And he thought, he said to us, you know, I don't understand why you put this out in English. And he said, if in English, at least it should have been in a subrochener English, in a broken English. Because it's a very beautiful literary style, from his perspective at least. The Hasidim hold the Shita. I always used to think that the reason they speak Yiddish is because they weren't educated. The reason they speak a broken English is because they weren't educated. How they got educated, would have spoken a good English. They hold the Shita, you shouldn't speak a good English. It's too dangerous. You shouldn't speak, you shouldn't write. If you're going to use English at all, it has to be a lousy, bad English.
Right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. One second. Yossi, are you unhappy about this?
I find it weird. Why combine like Russian and German into a...
Because that's a broken Russian and a broken German. That's great. It's not Russian, it's not German, it's not Hebrew. It's a totally dysfunctional language.
It's a pigeon language.
That's what they're looking for.
Why?
Yes.
Why? What's the purpose of that?
He just explained it to you.
What?
This way they can't assimilate the Russian. They're not German, they're not Russian.
I don't get it.
What do you mean you don't get it?
There's more of an explanation than that.
What?
I mean, there are people today, and they don't have money. If you know all languages, primary language is Yiddish. It seems kind of weird to intentionally do that, to intentionally, I don't know, not learn. I mean, like, it takes, like, some amount of, like, effort to not learn another language.
You see how much the Puma has crept into your soul? You think that it's good to speak the father language of the country. You think it's good to be able, you think it's useful and good to be able to communicate with people. Right?
Yes, it's useful.
You're just squish. They didn't change the language, yeah.
Yiddish is a
pigeon
language, but then...
But we like pigeon languages, that's the whole point. Who cares? I'd rather they think we're morons. That way they won't bother us. They won't want us to go in.
They're morons,
it's a pigeon language. Who cares? What's that love of Kolosham? Love of Kolosham is like, too bad, something bad in front of 10 Jews, not in front of 10 Goyim. It's like, so start walking on my hands in front of 10 Goyim. That's Kolosham.
Kolosham is something which is not Jewish.
Strictly speaking.
No,
Kolosham
is something which is not...
Okay, but I don't know what Kolosham is specifically.
You can speak Ladino also, whatever you want, just not English.
The language of the native country you're in. So if you're in English, in America, you shouldn't speak English. If you're in Germany, you shouldn't speak German. Is that the whole idea?
More or less.
Is this like a really set philosophical idea?
Yes!
But that's
almost
guaranteed. You're not going to get normal job, not going to get normal...
It's not the budget that the Lizbushes didn't agree. It could be that the Lizbushes never gave the matter thought. If you mean that nowadays we find there are Lizbushes who can speak a very good English, who write a very good English, right?
Yes,
but the Chabad Chaim couldn't speak Russian, and it was against being teachings of Russian. The famous Machlokes in the late, I'm jumping ahead in history now, of course, 100 years, but the end of 1800s, a big Machlokes at one of the great rabbinical assemblies as to whether rabbis should be urged to learn Russian. So, Rameir Simcha Zvinsk, your Sameach? Yes. Reb David Karliner, of Reb David Friedman of Karliner, held yes. The Chavetz Chaim?
No.
No. As a matter of fact, the way it was originally aligned was with the Or Sameach and Reb David Karliner versus the Tzemach Tzedek, Lubavitch Rebbe, and Reb Chaim Brisker. And Chavetz Chaim was the one who determined. You know, all the Chavetz Chaim is against rabbis learning Lashon.
So basically the situation was like now in America, that they even Russian didn't speak Russian.
Wait, how do you intentionally avoid learning another language?
What?
You avoid people who speak that language.
Just learn. I mean, just by being in an environment, you will learn another language.
No,
I don't
know
how
like you.
Have you ever walked out
through
this road?
Yeah, you avoid that environment. Well, go to Vision. There's no English speakers there. They avoid the environment.
But Samak said that also he didn't talk to Gwen too much.
Right.
The Mexicans don't speak English.
Right?
The Mexicans don't speak English. So,
but
that's
not
English.
I mean,
go to
Chinatown. And can't avoid it.
You can't avoid what?
You can't avoid speaking
of
language. You just
can't. Listen, why? You stop at Rockford Kosher. You let your wife talk when you go to Walmart. What's the problem?
It's okay if a woman speaks English?
Yeah. Because they don't care about their
English. What is this codified into philosophy, into the philosophic outlook?
You find sometimes in the internal takanos of these communities, there are takanos like this. But they don't publicize them, otherwise they couldn't get money from Hillary Clinton.
Well, in Eretz Yisrael,
you're voting for Hillary, right?
No, I want everyone to lose.
Okay, yeah.
In Eretz Yisrael, the same thing, they won't speak Hebrew.
No, it depends where. Yerushalayim, no, they won't.
No.
Yeah. See, the thing is, in Eretz Yisrael, Chazonish was very much was pro Hebrew. I know pro is the right word, but he reconciled himself.
Who was against
the fat version of the Torah classes?
They always was against
everything. Yeah. Right. So getting back to Mendelssohn, that's a tremendous breakthrough at the time to have all this German becoming popular in the household of Jews. And the rabbis were therefore very much opposed to it. There were some rabbis who opposed altogether because they didn't want the Jews and German to mix. There were other rabbis who were somewhat less stringent, and they were against reading Mendelssohn's introductions, because Mendelssohn's introductions to his very different svarim are very controversial because they speak about all sorts of analysis of Nevi'im, which we don't ever dare do. You know, like figuring out the personalities of Nevi'im and things like that. So we don't try and do that, so therefore that was considered even more dangerous, but there's certain places where the entire work was banned. Okay? Now, this is Mendelssohn's role. Later on, after Mendelssohn, there came a broader movement. The broader movement was called what? Anybody know what the broader movement is called? That's called a movement. That's called a movement is also not limited to Ashkenazi countries. There was there is in this very day the I don't know if you pronounce the French, but the Alliance schools, the Alliance of what? Yeah. Who said French? Yeah, it's French, right. So I don't know how to pronounce the French. Alliance Israelite University. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, but
why
it's all over all the Sephardi countries.
Why were certain prophecies included in Tanakh that are so controversial and hard to like comprehend? I mean, we need them, but like at the same time, like someone shunned to learn them, like learning from like a master.
I'm trying to figure out what the agenda is behind this question. What is the agenda behind this question?
Mendelssohn
analyzed.
It was controversial that he analyzed Nevi'im.
Right.
So, but he probably didn't say anything heretical in his analysis.
I don't know. I never read it.
Okay.
The question
was straightforward.
No, it wasn't.
it's like Nevi'im is like a huge part of our tradition, but we don't learn it traditionally. like, why are the prophecies, why are certain prophecies included and not left out if they're, like, so controversial to be learned?
I mean, why are we including dangerous parts in Tanakh?
Right. Because we did leave out a lot of other prophecies.
Yeah, well, obviously they're important for other reasons. Even though their danger is outweighed by their benefit.
Their benefit is outweighed by their danger.
No, obviously not.
The ones that are included.
Their benefit outweighs their danger.
Right.
Okay.
Wasn't Moses Mendelssohn friends with Immanuel Kant?
They were friendly. I don't think they were buddy-buddy. Because Kant had a negative view of Judaism, and I don't think Mendelssohn, you know, if he was very close to him, would try to have, I think Mendelssohn would try to have persuaded him, you know, been more persuasive, trying to argue the positive aspects of Judaism.
Who's Kant?
Immanuel Kant was a famous German philosopher who believed that all... What?
Well,
everything should be based on reason, and that not on emotion and not on practice. And it's very much interesting because Judaism is a practical religion, whereas Christianity is very theoretical, abstract. So he thought Christianity was a superior religion to Judaism. So.
What's Christianity
of strength? It's all about love. Deeds don't matter.
Doesn't
really matter what you do.
Would you turn the other sheet?
What?
Would you turn
but that's passive, it's not active. Would I turn the other sheet?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, you should go try. That's a very abstract and passive thing, not a very tangible, hands-on experiential thing. Anyway, so that scholar became a very massive movement throughout the world, Jewish world, as I said, including North African and other Sephardic countries, including Iran, some Persians mentioned before. What the scholar movement promoted was general intelligence. Literally, a scholar means intelligence. Seichel is the brain. So what they actually promoted were non-Jewish studies and non-Jewish pursuits. And the Gdolim at the time went ballistic. They couldn't take this concept because they saw non-Jewish studies as a tool by which the non-Jews were going to get the Jews to assimilate or convert to Christianity.
They used to use Judaism to get people assimilated. They taught everything intentionally from a very rationalist perspective in school. They thought they would teach... my understanding is that they would teach like Rambam and the teaching of the Yagon in, you know, in places like all the other Persians. Isn't that right?
Yes, I believe that is correct.
Did you have a skull in the United States?
No, because basically the Jews in the United States are always morons. A skull only could take root in a culture where people are thoughtful people.
So the
best place for us to go was actually Lithuania. Those people there were always thoughtful. Sometimes too good for the truth, thoughtful for their own good, but they were very thoughtful. You see what I'm saying? The cold analytical approach transferred over to Lithuania. Got it? I forgot how we got into this conversation. What did you ask to begin with? Did I answer it?
Yeah.
No, tell me what did you ask.
Was the assimilation a scholar movement?
What?
Was the scholar movement before that was...
Oh, in America. You asked me in America, right? You asked him before. So a scholar never took over in America. Basically, a scholar was in Eastern Europe and to a lesser extent in the Slavic countries, but in America never came an issue. In America, there are other issues. Don't worry, we'll get to America soon. But that scholar was never moved. Now, that Maskun themselves, what they did, and this was a big mistake on their part, they turned to the Russian government, for example, and tried to work there with the Russian government in promoting Haskola. A lot of the Maskun was sincerely convinced that their reforms were essential for the betterment of the Jewish condition, because Jews were ignorant, they were unskilled, they weren't going to school, So they were living in poverty. So therefore, if you give them training, give them schooling, they can go out and become accountants, lawyers, doctors, so on and so forth, and then they'll be able to better their position in this world. So they went to the Russian authorities, and they asked the Russian authorities to help them. And the Russian authorities were glad to help them. Problem is, the Russian authorities' agenda was not the same as the masculine's agenda. The Russian authorities' agenda was get the Jews to assimilate. So certain masculine gave up on Haskalah when they saw where it was going. Some of them moved away from Russia because they saw Russia was not a good place for it. What's interesting is that in Russia you have what develops eventually was not just, by Russia I mean including Lithuania, Latvia, and those places too, but what happened eventually is that you developed a Prum Haskalah also. A Prum Haskalah would be like somebody who had a good library, who had a good education, or of course a fine liberal arts education, other than the actual learning, which took place. So you have pictures of masculine from the late 1800s with long beards, you know, and payas and all that. What made them masculine? They were interested not just in learning, but also in general secular knowledge and culture as well. There are many of them.
Does that make someone masculine today?
Right.
Does that make somebody, like, part of masculine today? Or?
Well, today, any masculine are, I guess we would classify them all as pseudo-intellectual. Okay. You know, because they're not really, now we realize that because of overall, you know, the moral factor, right? Well, moral. So it's very rare that you find that. You know, if you go to the end of the 1800s, right? And you go into yeshiva like Slabaka or Valash and Rami or Tel, what are boys reading under their Gemaras? Marx, right? Tolstoy, Chagam, what?
Ovid,
Homer. You go today, what do boys have in their Gemaras?
They're on the internet.
Right, on the internet, they have Game Boys, you know, they're playing. Now, today, everybody is a stupid moron. That's the problem. Therefore, we don't even have, once at a time, the Yetzer Hara was a real Yetzer Hara. Now we're just a bunch of ninnies. There's no real hope for us. We're so stupid. Anyway, so be that tonight.
It might be more dangerous to remark.
I had this big argument once with Mike Caruso about 20 years ago at the same time when I was in Farakway, and he said he thinks for better off that the internet is what it is today. There was no internet back in the late 80s, or at least not widespread. The internet is, say, baseball, right? He's wrong. The only reason why the internet today is baseball is because we find Aristotle boring. I find Aristotle boring. Is that because I'm a better intellect or worse intellect than they were 100 years ago? Worse, right. So the Yetzer Hara, Kol HaGadol Mechabeiro, Yetzer Gadol Imenu. The bigger you are, the bigger Yetzer Hara you've got, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a small Yetzer Hara, it means you're a small person. Okay, yeah.
I think of Haskalah in Russia. I've been told that when Haskalah came, it never really spread in Russia because Eastern Europe was more similar to the Hasidus. So when it came to the Hasidic sort of sections of Eastern Europe, they're not really into that, whereas Western Europe took on the storm.
Yeah, but by Russia I meant what was under Russia's jurisdiction at the time, which includes Lithuania, Latvia, and parts of Poland. Right?
Even the Great Empire. But yeah. Lithuania would more be a place for me to think, because that's more of a Western European country.
You're right, that's why it was the most successful in Lithuania, yeah. You're correct, yeah.
Whereas Poland, it would just go nowhere.
So you just realize the word, right?
What?
You just word.
How does it work?
Lithuania was Litvash was very affected by Haskalah because people wasn't into like language into this. And came to Hasidim who was very intellectual people, and all from Samasadic or before, they're not affected by something. We see the Yiddish work.
Yiddish does work, that's true.
So I make fun of Yiddish here like this.
Can I make fun of Yiddish?
Yes, definitely.
Me?
And 1, 2, 3.
He did. Now what's the word for me? It was him. Can I make fun of Yiddish?
Wait, I made fun of Yiddish?
Yes.
What?
When Yiddish was developed?
It was developed in Germany in the early Middle Ages.
Speaking?
Wow, what time?
I guess 1300s or so.
In this book, Dor Lo Dor, it has...
That's the time one? Ladino was earlier. Ladino was early because it was developed in Spanish-speaking countries, where the Jews were all kicked out of in 1492. But, yeah, Ladino was a similar idea. They're both similar ideas.
Is speaking modern Hebrew in some religious circles considered, like, enlightenment?
Yes.
Oh, also.
Because it's the modern Hebrew is considered in some religious circles to be a separate language than Lashon HaKodesh.
What also?
So they wouldn't speak like a full sentence in Hebrew, unless it was like typical Hebrew, which is.
No, Adarava. They would speak sentences in modern Hebrew because it's not a language, right? No, they're both the modern Hebrew because it's the similar story, yeah. Not because.
So they wouldn't speak it.
Won't speak it. Yeah.
When Ben Yehuda started speaking Lashon HaKodesh, everyone got upset at him. I don't know what he did wrong. What did
he do? He started making up words.
Yeah, that's why.
I think it's probably part of the reason. Because a lot of my Hebrew is made up.
Oh, so he started making up words and they got upset at him?
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of does Chassid ever implement secular knowledge into their way of life? So let's say they don't want to speak English per se, let's want to read.
I can't sit down. The Chassidus holds the secular knowledge comes from the devil.
Devil? Who said that?
Why
would
they
go?
What?
Why would they?
I used to go to Amsterdam.
Wait,
who got that? Oh, you thinking? Tell me the story.
What? Yeah, no. The Hasidus believes that all sacred knowledge comes from Tuma.
Sitra Acha.
From Tuma Tachlipos. Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense that you want to, they want to like study Aristotle or something. Let's say they want to be into medicine. Like, it can't just be that all Hasidim are going to be diamond cutters.
Well, some will be cobbler, some will be blacksmith, some will be all sorts of. Yeah, but. They all said, look, not all Hasidim are like this. Obviously, you have Hasidim who have a lot of secular knowledge, but the majority of Hasidim hold.
I'm talking about old school Hasidim.
What? Well, several old schools are the same too. The majority of old schools have things held. Putting second knowledge into your brain is harmful to it.
So secular knowledge classifies anything as the secular world?
It does include math. You know, it includes but sciences, humanities, stuff like that, yeah.
Look at how many Jews have been led astray from the theories of evolution, the Big Bang, and stuff. So that gives them the ability to come up with all this stuff.
So Hasidus is very bold to say secular knowledge at all. We should try and avoid secular knowledge. Even Lubavitch, you know, Lubavitch read himself studied in, you know, in secular colleges, but he told his followers to avoid them all.
Besides, very few. Very few was in college.
Right, and most of those, a lot of them were probably tshuva, meaning they learned all the secular stuff before they became pro. Right, like people like Professor Bronnenberg. His name is Lubavitcher, a scientist.
Yeah.
So he learned all of his science before he became fluent. So therefore, that was okay. He didn't have to forget it once he became fluent. But who brought this up?
I agree.
Oh. So, so Hasidim, they don't believe in any secular knowledge having any specific value. Sometimes it's necessary to have in order to make a living, but in of itself, it has no value, and it might be from the situation from the other side, actually. Okay? That's why that Chabad movement does not succeed at all against Hasidim. It only succeeded with the Litvaks and the Germans, of course, because the Litvaks didn't have that emotional apathy or an apathy is the wrong word, animosity towards secular studies.
So there was no Hasidim and more affected at all?
Very little, very little. Lefessel writes about that. He says that The Hasidim were much less affected by Haskalah than even Bali Musa, because Bali Musa is a very rigorous and very somewhat narrow perspective on things, right? So some people rebelled against Musa and looked for stuff in other places, psychology and things like that. But Hasidim almost no rebellion in Hasidim. The Hasidim aren't true. Right? You go to the web today, you can find many web pages of people who used to be Hasidim and now they're not true. Right? But not because they wanted to become more intellectual, they didn't become true. They became non-Orthodox. Because they want to have a good time. Right? It's a very big difference. So the Litvaks were very much susceptible to this intellectual thing. But I had a boss in art, one of my bosses in art school once said he's sure that in the near future sometime there will be a second Haskalah backlash. He said because now Yeshiva Bachim are being told that there is no value in second studies. And they're just being pushed to Limudei Kodesh by Jewish studies. So eventually they're going to find out that there is something significant, enjoyable, and educational in secular studies. There's going to be a massive backlash against the Yeshiva movement. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's his theory.
What
do you
mean,
yeah, because they didn't teach him anything about life.
He didn't know math, he didn't know nothing. Just to read
the Bible.
What? They know more than in Israel. In Israel, the cloud situation is crazy. Because in Israel, the really right-wing religious, they know nothing. They learn nothing. Nothing.
Not math,
not anything, yeah. So, an American Jewish writer, 20 years ago, so, wrote a book on Haredi society and their control, right, right-wing society. So he took a map of Israel and asked some kids in ultra-Orthodox schools to pinpoint places on the map where Zaria was, Tiberias, where Beit Lechem was, where, you know, Haifa. They couldn't do it.
They're not secular.
It's just non-Torah.
They don't know where
because they take the bus there, but you know, places where they don't go.
You can't find it on the map.
What?
That's the thing. You can't find it on the map.
Maybe they can find a map. I don't know. There's the things like this, even in America, I think I told you this once, that I once asked one of the Rosh Yeshiva in the Mir in Brooklyn, how many, I once asked him one of his sons, asked one of his sons, how many states are in the United States? I was like a 17-year-old boy. And he said, 32. So he wasn't joking. Because that is that attitude, not just among Hasidim. But on the other hand, the flip side is that keeps people very strong. If you speak a broken English, then you can't get involved with other people.
Strong, it's not knowing any better.
Fine, whatever you want to call it, but it keeps you away from it.
I'm not saying you go with money. I'm saying how do you know how to do these things?
We're following, Mike.
I think it's a waste.
A waste of what?
A waste of money for one thing. Pay them to do everything for you. You learn to yourself and give them money to your receiver.
But since there's a buffer zone between you and the rest of the world. By the way, this you should know that's very bad. This is why the Lipa Schmelzer concert was a very big danger.
Wow.
You guys know about the Lipa Schmelzer concert, which was canceled? There's supposed to be a Lipa Schmelzer concert called the Big Event.
Is it got some there?
Right?
Yeah. What?
From what?
No, March 9th. Next week.
Oh, you got New Square, right?
What?
You got New Square?
Not anymore. They moved out.
Alright.
Wait, what?
Right. So it's canceled.
Why?
Because the Hasidim see Lipa as a very big threat. Because here you have this Hasidish guy who has a Shtreimel, has Payas, you know, and he's going around singing Jewish songs to Jewish words to the Lion King. You know, this is very, very difficult for them to deal with. Whatever, it's a popular non-Jewish movie.
That would only resonate if you've actually seen that non-Jewish movie.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
They know by the beat. They can tell. They can tell by the way Lipa dances.
You have some mercy.
Anyway, I love it. So God's in a mic. The point is that...
like a line or something? Like, how do they...
What? You're asking questions beyond my level of expertise. But somehow they found out, and if David, then, in other words, if Mordecai Ben David starts jumping around and starts singing non-Jewish songs, that doesn't bother them much because Mordecai Ben David is not one of them. Yeah, but he's not practicing.
The problem with Lipa, not the other two fingers?
No, because Lipa is Hasidish, so therefore it was a very big problem for them. Okay? If you were Karlbach making concerts, that doesn't bother them. No self-respecting concerts are going to say, Karlbach is my role model, right? But Lipa could be a role model. Okay?
I'm sure there's probably a lot of Hasidim who are role model.
But it still is not a problem because he's not, his music is not aimed at a full audience. He's not trying to make music for Orthodox Jews. Yeah. So it's not a problem. But nevertheless, Lubavitch also, they kicked Matisyahu out, yeah. Basically. Yeah, he's no longer Matisyahu Lubavitch or Chosid. So the Haskalah movement in general was built on this assumption that it's good for Jews to have secular knowledge. And with that secular knowledge, you can go further in the country and they become better people also. Two things. Pragmatic, it's better for them as far as citizens of their country, and it also makes you a better person to have lots of knowledge, including secular knowledge. Judaism refuted this on two accounts. They didn't want to be better citizens of the country. That's why most of the rabbinim in Europe were opposed to the emancipation. They didn't want Jews to have full rights as citizens. They wanted Jews to remain second and third class citizens behind the walls of the ghetto, because they're afraid if the Jews were emancipated, they all assimilate.
Which people keep people in the cage.
Right. They have people in the cage.
But how does that look now? It's like something where you look back from an open-minded perspective, and see that these rabbis trying to keep people poor. That's how they would see it. I mean, that perspective is very tentative. It's very hard to maintain, isn't it?
Not necessarily.
I mean,
if you see spiritual danger above all other dangers, why would it be hard to maintain?
Now, the Baba Shirebi in Russia, was he for...
secular studies?
What was he for?
Who? Which
one?
Selah was against that thought movement. No, it was against all these kinds of things.
Oh, and that's not the old one was against.
So he was for the Pope. He was against the Pope.
Against Napoleon, right. That's why the Baba Tanya defeated Napoleon. You know that.
Isn't there
about about time to defeat Napoleon?
Yeah, there's someone there. So
what?
Is someone there?
No, he sang songs. Rachamanu Yizakenu Imoshav Moshiach. If you took take the music of the non-Jew, right, which is the French national anthem, and use it for kedusha, and you're the right rebbe.
So
no, Napoleon.
No,
okay.
And the second group of Frey Shaken and then praying to win Napoleon.
That's all.
The first thing was
accepted show. Maybe it's got
news
where
he's
taking very soon
to
make it holy.
No, but he's not a rabbi, you can't do that.
Isn't there a part of our job in this world is to be an example and to make a better place to be out there and, you know.
That's what I think, and you think.
How is that accomplished by. You don't think that.
Sorry,
again, I don't believe in what I told.
Yeah. Alright, well, so I think we'll stop here for tonight. Next week we'll finish with that. The big fish.
I'm going to finish the chapel.